So kernel processing of ensile materials, it's not a new technology. It was very popular in Europe many years ago. And in about the late 90s, new harvesting equipment had become available from the large equipment manufacturers that actually had built-in kernel processors attached, which is really just an onboard roller mill right behind the silage cutter. This in a combination with greater amounts of corn acres being used and higher dry matter silages became a pretty important tool that really got its footing in the dairy space.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with nonlinear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. Kemin invites you to optimize animal feed quality and safety with our portfolio of solutions. Learn more at kemin.com/ag. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge. Now, you see it. Intelligent feed management from BinCentury.
Welcome to the Feed Science Podcast from North Carolina State University's Animal Food Processing Program. I'm Adam Fahrenholz. Thanks for joining us. As always, whether you be watching on YouTube or listening on your favorite podcast feed, do like and subscribe and all that good stuff, as well as provide us feedback on the things you like from the various episodes that we do and give us ideas for things in the that we might be able to do in the future. We've got ourselves a returning guest today. Dr. Zach Smith. Zach is the is an associate professor of feedlot nutrition and management at South Dakota State University, and serves as the faculty supervisor of the Ruminant Nutrition Center and Laboratory. Zach, thanks for joining us again.
Hey, thanks for having me again, Adam. I appreciate you having me on the podcast.
Yeah, you bet. So, as I mentioned, Zach's joined us in the past, and we've talked some things about ruminant and especially feedlot nutrition, and we got some interesting stuff to talk about today. But before we jump right into that, for those that might not have seen that previous episode, Zach, if you'd give them just a little bit of your background and then especially what it is that you and your team focus there at SDSU.
I'll give the abbreviated version. Zach Smith, South Dakota State University. I did my undergrad work at Texas Tech University. I was on a wool meats and livestock judging team there, started out as a freshman and went all the way through. And then I did my master's degree at South Dakota State University. My advisor at that time was Dr. Robbie Pritchard. He too had come from Texas Tech and went to South Dakota State when he became a faculty member. And then I did my PhD back home in Texas with a South Dakota native, Dr. Bradley Johnson. And much of my training in graduate school was really applied feedlot nutrition and management, so beef cattle nutrition and management sciences. Dealt a little bit in some other aspects of molecular biology, but now I find my home place as doing research that looks at the impact of nutritional strategies or management interventions that optimize production and efficiency of calves from the time of weaning through harvest. And so my lab group, we're a team of faculty members, Dr. Warren Rushi, Dr. Aaron DeHaan, Dr. Ana Clara Meneses. We all kind of make up co-parts of the feedlot research group. And then we, amongst the four of us, we train somewhere between, just depends on the year, 10 and 14 graduate students. So students seek an MS and PhD degrees. And our research really, like I said, is from weaning till harvest. And so every fall, we start with balling calves, newly weaned calves. We turn those calves over from a receiving period study into a growing or backgrounding phase experiment. That's currently what we're working on now, is the kind of the growing part of the feedlot confinement time. And here in about 2 months, we'll start our finishing phase research. We operate two feedlots here on the eastern side of South Dakota. Colleague Aaron DeHaan, she's got another research feedlot out kind of in the middle central portion of the state near Phillips, South Dakota. And collectively, we use all of these different experiment station entities to answer questions that benefit our stakeholders here in South Dakota, but also try to make this research applicable to the entire Great Plains, U.S., and really to the whole world as the lens we look through, but truly through the lens of a what I'd call a farmer feeder. So an individual that raises crops or raises has some sort of land in production where they harvest that material and then they feed it to the cattle and then they take those nutrients that the livestock produce and we reapply it back into the environment the feed was grown from. So a little different than the size and scope and scale of feedlots, you know, the more larger feedlots in other parts of the world. But that's where we work at and what we spend every day trying to answer questions about.
Very good. Before we jump into it, you mentioned you've got a couple of feedlots there. You've got some other stuff throughout the state. Just, you know, to high level view, I guess, in case anybody that's listening is someone that's like, you know, I'd like to go, you know, maybe do some work with them, or maybe we've got someone listening from an allied, you know, that sounds like somebody we could work with for some questions we have to answer. What are your overall capabilities? Because obviously you're feeding them, but I know at one point we had some, you know, we were getting ready to schedule a podcast and you had stuff coming in where it's like, hey, we've got to do some necropsies and some sampling today. So you guys obviously can do a lot there. So like, what does that look like?
It's not just feed them and weigh them research.
Yeah.
A lot of our research, you know, that molecular biology training I got during my PhD, we do a lot of kind of intensive sampling type things. So the work you were talking about was a pre-harvest skeletal muscle and hepatic tissue biopsy where we were collecting tissues after those animals had been fed prior to slaughter to look at changes in the RNA expression and protein quantity in those differing tissue pools. So, yeah, we do, you know, I would say really – depending upon the answer that the company's after, right? You know, I always say there's show and tell and then there's research. And from a research perspective, you know, within our system, we can have an adequate number of replicate pins to pick up very small differences in dry matter feed conversion. And so our research feedlots are, in essence, a 15,000 head yard shrunk down to the size of a 300 head yard. And so the amount of variation that we have in our daily feed calls, instead of having a big mixer that breaks at 10 or 20 pounds, we have it break at 1 pound. And our scales, instead of doing pin weights where you put a quite a few, you know, 20 head on a pin scale that has a 10 pound break, we have a scale that gets down to the nearest pound or half a pound. And so we can apply that precision to get at real true world feed conversion differences. You know, small pin research isn't, if you've got a product that you think is going to alter marbling score, if you just do a feeding trial with that, you don't have enough animals to really pick up true differences in marbling. But we can go a step further and we can collect skeletal muscle tissue or adipose tissue and look at those RNA expression or protein changes when we apply that technology to the critter. We also can do lots of intensive blood sampling. We do that nearly every study. We're getting blood harvested to look at various metabolite responses to treatment interventions or management interventions. So, you know, big commercial feedlots there, they can really get you an answer on changes in quality grade distribution, yield grade responses, carcass weight responses. We can do carcass weight pretty good here too. But if you're just after growth productivity or things like that, a small pen university setting is oftentimes the least expensive place to capture the information. And while you're doing it, you also get the opportunity to help train the technical expertise that one day that you're going to want to hire, or you're going to want them to use your products or all those things. So really a graduate school, although as we look into the world in the future and people, you know, companies wanting to keep things internally or their trade secrets to different feedlot entities, there's still a really important purpose about graduate training, and that is training the technical experts that we need to hire in the next 5, 10, 25 years. And so that's why I like what I do. But yeah, we do a lot of random things. It's not just weigh cattle and feed them. We're pretty intensive sampling.
It's more fun that way. More fun that way for sure.
Yeah, no doubt.
Anybody that's looking to do some beef cattle ruminant type research, go see Zach for sure.
We're always ready to help out some way.
Evonik Animal Nutrition is committed to ensure food security and safety while reducing the ecological footprint of animal farming. Its products and services use evidence-based solutions that seek to promote animal welfare and reduce reliance on natural resources. All this is underpinned by long-standing industry partnerships and deep customer understanding. Evonik's focus on efficiency, sustainable, healthy nutrition, and collaborations with livestock farming partners creates value for customers and consumers.
All right, so the topic today, we're actually going to talk about some quote feed type things, some feed manufacturing in some ways. We're going to talk about the idea of kernel processing for ensiled feed. So question number one is, what does kernel processing mean?
So kernel processing of ensiled materials, it's not a new technology. It was very popular in Europe many years ago. And in about the late 90s, new harvesting equipment had become available from the large equipment manufacturers that actually had built-in kernel processors attached, which is really just an onboard roller mill right behind the silage cutter. This in a combination with greater amounts of corn acres being used and higher dry matter silages became a pretty important tool that really got its footing in the dairy space. All right. And so, you know, 40 years ago, folks that put up silage, feedlots were probably not any smaller in scale, but they were integrated crop livestock systems, and those still exist today. But they harvested, they weren't just corn farmers. And so they did want to grow silage because in South Dakota, you know, if you just take field corn, there's a chance that you're going to be harvesting corn out of snowbanks. And so we have livestock to help mitigate some of those risks. We're an integrated cropping and livestocking system where we can take different components of the corn plant and the silage, it's the whole crop. We can harvest that earlier in the season so that we're not having what I'd call a crazy mission to get all of our grain harvested, put in a bin. We got to get it pulled out of the field wet, then we have to dry it. When you have livestock, you have an opportunity to use this corn in different strategies, whether that's a silage or high moisture corn or dry corn that you might sell to an ethanol plant. Or if you got to take wet corn, you don't have to dry it because you're going to feed it to your livestock. Well, a lot of the equipment that was around was just an old pull behind silage chopper to a tractor. They were very small in size. You know, think about dairies 40 years ago were a lot fewer cows than the larger dairies we have today. And so that equipment worked well. As dairies became larger and all feeding entities became larger, there was kind of a bit less focus on the crop, the getting the crop out of the field. They would hire that out. Custom harvester would come, and those guys are paid to get the crop out of the ground and move on to the next farm. And so the equipment got larger, and the capabilities of what we could do to that material also became better because there were people that were just full-time harvesting silage. And the kernel processors really, they took over. Nearly all corn silage that you get nowadays is likely kernel processed because not many of the silage harvesters that are made don't have a kernel processor unless you're using really old equipment. And there's a benefit to that, especially in dairy cattle. That's where it definitely took off. When you've got a cow that's consuming such a large volume of feed and rate of passage is really high, as we eat more and increase rate of passage, our digestibility of total tract organic matter constituents, so things like fiber and starch, they actually reduce. It just spends less retention time in the alimentary tract. And so kernel processing corn silage was a really great way in dairies for us to capture more of the available energy from that corn grain by breaking it into a bunch of little pieces instead of leaving some whole or partially cracked corn particles. So kernel processing is just a roller mill attached to the back of a silage harvester. It's really taken off in the last 25 years as we've changed the size and scale and scope of farms to where some of that farming enterprise activities get doled out to custom harvesting groups that can get that material. And it's a no-brainer on dairies. It needs to be used. But in the beef space, that's kind of where we were curious if it needs to be used or not, because we still got a lot of people in South Dakota that feed 200 head of calves, and they still got dad's old silage harvester that they pulled behind their tractor. And we wanted to know if they needed to do it. And this is where we've spent a lot of our time and research on kernel processing silage past few years. Now, I will say this. If you're working with other material like grain sorghum that's harvested as silage, you probably need to process that because those berries are really hard and small. So it kind of just depends on the material that you're getting and what you what type of equipment you want to use of your own or if you want to send it out for somebody else to do.
Most of the folks that are using new equipment sound like they're doing kernel processing. Certainly if they're larger, they're kernel processing, which probably means most of our large commercial dairies are kernel processing. You guys are looking at whether or not it makes sense for maybe the smaller special feedlot beef producers to do it.
And I'll be honest with you, Adam, so half of our ideas come from something they did on a dairy that I'm just like, does it even matter? Sure. And maybe it does, and sometimes it actually it doesn't. And so there's not a one-size-fits-all approach to cattle feed. They're totally different.
Yeah, I was say, you're telling me not all cattle are the same, huh? I just thought, you know, they all had a rumen, and we just kind of moved on from there. Okay.
You got a difference, and I can show you some data that, you know, coarse grains in cattle are actually more highly digested, more fully digested than they are in cows, dairy cows. And that
interesting.
Yeah, that's just, it's good info to know.
We've talked about how you're going to check if it's working and if it's where it needs to be. And for all the folks that are on the feed manufacturing side, and that should all make a lot of sense because we do the exact same thing. You know, we get really into our particle size analysis, but at the very beginning, it's kind of what you described, right? It's all right. As we're setting this roller mill, let's say, just get a sample, look at it by hand and go, yeah, I'm close or nah, I'm not close. Let me make some adjustment. Then we'll take it to the Rotap and stuff after that. From the standpoint of, okay, we do this a lot in the dairy, but you're talking about maybe taking it into the feed side. What do you actually pick up from a data standpoint? Like when you do this, does it make it better, all the different performance metrics? Is it a lot better, a little better? What have you guys found so far?
I guess the correct answer to that is it depends. So, you know, the little backstory on how we came into this work, it's 2019. I was driving down from Brookings to Omaha for a Midwest Animal Science meeting. And I think I told this story last time I was on the podcast. We left, Brookings Monday morning and there was snow all over Eastern South Dakota, all the way to Omaha. We left Wednesday afternoon from Omaha and drove back and all the snow had melted and it had screwed things up so bad. In fact, it messed up the ability to get things planted. And so there was a lot of flooding that occurred. And so some prevent plant acres were put into production so that the ground wouldn't be fallow. And then they actually had the opportunity to harvest that material in the fall. But that fall, it got pretty dry in the middle of summer, and then it rained again, and the corn canopy was grown up, and we had to delay harvest. So late getting it in, get it right on time, and then we delayed harvest. And so that's when I initially got the idea. I was like, well, I should look into, like, what happens if we delay corn silage harvest, you know? Are we totally, you know, out of luck? And if we do delay harvest, you know, does kernel processing break those hard corn kernels? And is that important? And it is. It does change the processing score as corn matures. It does a better job of fracturing those not as soft corn kernels. So that was the first study, and I did it backwards. I did it in finishing cattle first. At a low inclusion, we were feeding the silage only as the roughage source is what we call it. Finishing diets is the material to cause rumination and scratch factor. And so the inclusion of that was 24% of dietary dry matter. So only about 12 points of roughage. It was 10 or 20 or 24. I forget off the top of my head, actually. I could pull the file up. And what we saw is that when we fed kernel processed corn silage, or not, in that deal where we were feeding a really low level of corn silage, we didn't see any differences in intake or feed conversion or daily gain. All right. So that there wasn't a big apparent benefit to processing the silage. But you got to remember, it was a really low inclusion level. And there had been some work done at Nebraska at UNL with one of Dr. Galen Erickson's graduate students, where they did see a response, but they were feeding it to growing calves, and they were, you know, 2/3 to 3/4 of the diet was the corn silage instead of less than a quarter. And in that instance, if corn silage is half grain, and the way we determine that is we assay the whole plant, the silage material, and let's say it comes back at 36% starch. On a dry matter basis. So you take that 36 and you divide it by 0.72, and that's 50% grain. It's 50% grain, 50% fodder. So when you feed it at a quarter of the diet, you know, it's only 12% of the grain that's not processed. When you feed it at 75% of diet dry matter, it's up to 37.5% of the grain that's either processed or not. And it did make a difference there, about a 3% improvement in feed conversion, if my memory serves me correctly, is what Galen and his group saw when they processed it. So we went back and we did it with growing cattle, and we saw nearly an identical response in feed conversion that they had seen at UNL. But surprisingly, we didn't see any responses in the total tract digestibility of starch. It actually appeared to be a ability to better digest the NDF in the growing cattle diets. So in dairies, they're looking at fecal starch, and that's their measurement. We didn't measure that in our study. Well, we did, but that wasn't just what we were checking. We're checking total tract digestibility of all the organic constituents, the NDF, the ADF, the starch, and the nitrogen. And so what we saw in that particular study was that when it makes up a large component of the diet, it really does enhance it does have an enhancement in feed conversion efficiency, but when it's used in really small inclusions, like might be used in a finishing diet, doesn't make a big deal. Now, the problem with this is that people that grow cattle and then finish them, it's not like they have two silage piles. Okay. So I would say kernel process your silage, actually, if you can. If you have the material, don't tell the guy not to run it. But you can still get by without using it. We did some more work with earlage. Now, earlage is a little bit of a different type of material. Earlage is it's the cob, the corn, and the husk. And it's a corn picker head pulls the corn cob off, and then we process it through a silage harvester. So it's a corn head on a forage processing tractor or machinery. And in that particular study, we either kernel processed the earlage or we didn't. And surprisingly, and I was like, for sure, now we're talking about a material that's instead of half grain, it's 80 to 90% grain. And in that study, again, nothing happened. And this was a well-replicated study. We had 11 reps per treatment. We should have been able to pick up teeny tiny differences in feed conversion. And so after that study, I'm sitting there scratching my head like, son of a gun, happened again. But then I got back and felt comfort in our data that we know is out there that, you know, feedlot cattle, they just consume and eat their feed differently than cattle that are dairy cows. Dairy cows, they slop it down. Feedlot steers eat 4 to 8 small meals a day. They chew on their food a lot more than a dairy cow does. And so they've got their own built-in processor. And so the take home on the earlage study was, and I feel pretty confident telling our stakeholders this, is that if you've got a limited harvest window, because you're working around Mother Nature, crop dry down, all these things, that if you break down and your kernel processor's broken, don't stop harvest. Just get your material, get it put up. You're going to feed it for a whole year, and you're going to have to live with it, but it's not going to be the end of the world. On a dairy, that's probably a different scenario, and I'm not a dairy man, so I would say they would tell me absolutely not. They would not even consider that. But at least in beef cattle, feedlot animals, it's not as much of a negative as I thought it was before we started this particular work.
That's a really interesting perspective. I'm glad you got into that, because there's always that idea. I mean, at the very, very, very end of the day, the animal's got to eat. And so whatever we got to do to make sure they got food, they have food. But there is going to be a difference depending on just how much it matters, whether it's, look, there's a return on investment and there's a risk assessment here. And there's always a line, right? And so, you know, what she just talked about, it's like on the beef cattle, on the beef cattle side, it might be like, look, if you got time to fix it and you got time to make it work, I probably would. But if you're watching the weather come in and you're like, this could cost me if I wait, and you'll be fine. As where the dairy guys, like, I would suggest you have parts on hand.
Yeah, exactly.
And you have someone that knows how can fix it right now, and they be there and trained and know it, because you obviously
downtime.
You obviously the weather's a problem for you too, but the risk here is way higher, so you got to approach that assessment completely different.
And maybe beef cattle people were ignorant to the fact that the dairy people know every day they're feeding them is in the bulk tank.
Yeah.
And a lot of times in the confinement beef space, feedlot space, we don't really know till the end, which is why we do these studies, and you know, we're not looking day to day. And sometimes I had a buddy one time, Alfredo. He actually did some work where he took daily dry matters and started adjusting his diets, as opposed to weekly, or as opposed to just using a book value and letting it run. And picking one number and sticking with it, although the moisture of the ingredients might change slightly, wasn't any worse than daily updates. The cattle are pretty resilient. That system works. And so when we were trying to outsmart the system and manage it, it created a lot more work for them, and there was no perceived benefit, at least in the beef animal. Sometimes I think the resolution to the degree of which your management you apply can drive you crazy. That it might not be as big of a difference as we thought.
Yeah, no. And that sounds like a whole nother podcast episode we could do. It's that idea of some of like the precision livestock farming, which I'm not knocking. More data, better. Always. Right. But at the same time, it's like, yeah, but make sure you have an idea. And I'm going to raise my hand on maybe the more of the poultry and the swine side, and certainly the feed milling side, to say the same thing you said earlier, like, you want to find out if it works or not, like, you know, here. And if you want to come in and find a place to install, you know, this $100,000 data collection system up here, would love to do it. But also, you probably want to go through that step, because if you do it at scale and you've got more data, but as it turned out, you can't even pick up the difference there, because turns out many, many years of doing this has actually made your system pretty good, and there's just not that much more improvement to pull out of it. You'd like to know that before you spend the money.
For sure. No, there's no doubt about that.
Podcast episode for the future.
Heck yeah.
My guest today has been Dr. Zach Smith. Zach is an associate professor in the Department of Animal Science at South Dakota State University. And as he mentioned, he serves as the faculty supervisor for the Ruminant Nutrition Center and Laboratory. Zach, it's always a fun conversation. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. And we're in an unusual time up here. It's like, it's winter, obviously, but we have no snow on the ground. And I just invested in my first snow blower. So I'm
well, that's why there's no snow. So everybody in South Dakota can thank you, Zach. He went ahead and bought a snow blower that he doesn't need. And that's why you have no snow.
After 8 years in the Dakotas, I finally broke down and, I bought one, from a buddy that got a new one. And I was like, yeah, you know what? That might be pretty nice on some days. So waiting for it to snow.
There you go. Absolutely. I appreciate your time.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Again, this has been the Feed Science Podcast Show. I'm Adam Fahrenholz from North Carolina State University. On behalf of Wisenetics, thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. And we'll talk to you the next time.
Thanks, Adam.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.